Everybody. My name is Josh Beniston, and I am a PhD student at Ohio State. So I'm here on behalf of my major advisor, Ratan Lal, this morning. Dr. Lal sends his regards. He regretted that he couldn't be here in San Antonio, but he did prepare these slides that I'm going to go through on the subject of carbon sequestration and nutrient cycling in urban soils. So we're going to sort of move outward and look at a much bigger picture look at urban soils here. So if we look at the data on urbanization globally, we see some big things that most people here are probably aware of, that we have an increasingly urban global population. And at about 2007, we crossed the threshold where more than half the people on the planet are now living in cities globally. Very similar trends can be seen in the United States, where between 1960 and 2010, we had a doubling of the urban population from 130 million up to about 260. And it's projected that over the next 40 years, we will have another 100 million people living in our cities in the U.S. and get up to about 364 million people. Ohio, similar trends also, where in 1950 we had 70% urban population, and more recently 77% of our population was urban. But urbanization and the carbon cycle are not just about population. So in thinking about land area that's involved in urbanization, if we look at some of the major urban areas of the planet, we see that their metropolitan footprint takes up some significant areas, that the metropolitan area of New York can extend out for almost 1 million hectares, and some of our other major cities in the U.S. about 500,000 hectares. If we look at the total area that is under urban systems in our nation and how that's changed through time, we see a really drastic increase here, where at the World War II era in 1945, there were only about 5 million hectares of urban land, and that number has gone up by a factor of five to about 25 million hectares more recently, 2002. So to look at the figures on an annual basis, we can see that globally, about 2 million hectares of land are converted into urban areas every year. And the majority of that land, according to this data, is formerly agricultural land, 1.6 million hectares, and the remaining from forests and grassland and more native ecosystems. So this is a photo from right outside of Columbus, where we live. And this shows a scene that was very typical there until about 2 years ago, where over the last 20 years or so, a lot of what was previously farmland in rural areas outside the outer belt of Columbus have become increasingly urbanized and suburbanized. And this is a situation that probably a lot of people here see where they live. And, you know, we have joked about the irony among soil scientists at Ohio State that, you know, people have been building houses on USDA prime farmland in Columbus, and now soil scientists in Ohio are running around trying to repair urban soils so that people can grow food in them. So, you know, this is a familiar story. If we look just at the data from our own nation, we can see that between the late 70s and 2000, there was about 1 million hectares of land per year that was being converted from rural land uses into urban land uses. And again, about half of that was farmland, and about 40% of that could be considered prime agricultural land. So again, what's really driving a lot of this is population growth and the increasing desire of the world's population to live in cities. You know, the basic estimate is that about 70 to 80 million people new people are coming onto the planet each year. We had one of those in my house this year. So, and in terms of looking at the per capita land area that's needed to sustain this kind of population growth, you know, Dr. Lyles calculated that about 40,000 hectares of land is needed to provide the basic living needs for 1 million people. So that this translates to about 3 million hectares of additional land that's being converted to urban areas each year to accommodate the new increases in population. And if we look just simply at food production to meet people's basic needs in urban areas, we can see that in a few more years, we're going to have 236 cities in the world with a population of 10 million or more. That's just a staggering number to me. And a city this size requires 6,000 tons of food per day to sustain its population. So one thing that we've been looking at in Ohio and that people have been looking at across North America a lot more recently is just the potential to produce some of this food, some small amount, locally within the urban footprint. So here's some data from Canada and Vancouver where we see that they have some significant areas, thousands of hectares, that are being devoted to fruit and vegetable production and nursery crops, and that those areas have been increasing on an annual basis in the decade from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s. Some recent estimates from our region of the country. As the first speaker described, Ohio and our cities are very similar to Detroit. We have a lot of vacant, open urban land that is a result of the population declines that came when industry and steel production moved overseas. And so communities are, you know, looking for positive uses for that space. It becomes derelict and causes a lot of problems otherwise. And so urban agriculture and community gardens have really become quite a hot topic in our region. And so we had a group from Ohio State who took a look at Cleveland and did some basic calculations and found that if the city of Cleveland were to put 80% of their vacant lots into fruit and vegetable production, that depending on the yield estimate, that could produce somewhere between a third and two-thirds of the fruit and vegetable consumption needed for that city. And Cleveland's unique also in that because there's so much vacant land, the Cleveland City Council recently passed an ordinance that allows people to keep chickens and bees within the city. And so, you know, if we incorporated those into the equation, then upwards of 94% of poultry products could be produced within the urban footprint and 100% of honey. And a group from Michigan State found very similar numbers looking at Detroit's vacant land. And as the first speaker mentioned, Detroit has more than enough land to support those figures. And those are based on the recommended levels of vegetable and fruit consumption, which are higher than the current consumption levels. And I looked at both these papers. I've been doing research on this topic, and the kilogram per meter squared figures that they were using seem really reasonable when you look at the literature. So I think those are very achievable numbers right there. Switching gears and looking at carbon sequestration and turf grass. This is something that we've had a few people in our group have looked at. Sort of the simple calculation for our nation is that we have about 16 million hectares of land in turf grass or lawns, and that the rates of carbon sequestration in soil in those systems vary in the literature between about 0.3 and about 1 megagrams of carbon per hectare per year. So we see that this is gives us a generic potential of between 5 and 16 teragrams of carbon per year that we are sequestering in soil from lawns. And looking at the global carbon cycle and how urban areas play a role, in 2010, despite the figures I showed about how much land is being put into urban areas each year, only about 2% of the planet was considered an urban area. But a number of studies, including a 2011 report from the UN, estimate that upwards of 70% of all of our anthropogenic carbon emissions are associated with meeting the needs of urban areas, with not just activities within the city, but energy production to sustain cities. And urban areas are also, they have a distinct carbon cycle from more natural systems, where we see large horizontal flows of carbon both coming into and out of cities that you don't see in more natural settings. And so this is really a function of the what Dr. Lau describes as the ecological characteristics of an urban area, that cities have a more intensive energy metabolism per unit area, and they require large amounts of materials to be brought in, the forms of food and water and building materials, and that they also emit a much larger amount of pollutants and emissions, so that it's a distinct biogeochemistry in urban areas from more natural areas. We can see that this is an interesting study here that looked at the density of carbon in urban areas in the U.S., and they found that they calculated that urban areas had a very high carbon density of 23 to 42 kilograms of carbon per meter squared, and that this number was actually higher than tropical forests, which are considered to have the highest carbon density of natural systems. They looked and they said that in 2000, 10% of the total carbon storage in the U.S. was in urban areas. And of interest to us, they calculated that 64% of that carbon was in the soil in cities, and that an additional 20% was in vegetation, 11% in landfills, and 5% in buildings. So this data here suggests that urban areas and urban soils can be a somewhat significant carbon pool globally for management. And, you know, part of this is because in addition to the more broken ecology of the city, we do have natural areas and areas such as lawn and trees and vegetated areas that are doing, you know, have photosynthesis going on and are storing carbon in vegetation and in soils. But the downside to this is that it requires energy to maintain a lot of these systems. We get high productivity in urban areas oftentimes because of a high rate of inputs, both of water and fertilizer and fossil fuels for management of these areas. So if we were to take a general model and compare the net primary productivity of an urban ecosystem versus a more natural ecosystem, we can see that there are estimates out there that suggest that the productivity is higher in urban green spaces than in more natural systems. But as I just mentioned, this comes with inputs in the form of fertilizer, and that if we were to compare that in a purely energy form, that the energy use maintaining urban landscapes is really quite similar to the energy use in cornfields in the U.S. And so the third thing here is that, as we mentioned, the horizontal flows of carbon are distinct for urban areas. So in a natural ecosystem, you don't have much export of productivity and of carbon, whereas in the urban ecosystem, it's been calculated that about half of the biomass produced in the city then is exported out into surrounding areas in the interest of maintaining manicured landscapes, really. So in the 1970s, Odom produced a concept of green city space that, you know, showed the value of open space in cities. And so Dr. Lau has some figures here that suggest that in the 1970s we had much larger areas of open land and green space in our urban areas, and that that in the 2000s we have maybe only 16% of the land area in cities in green space. So increasingly we're asking more and more ecological services and functions out of a smaller area in urban areas. We look at the process of urbanization and the conversion of land into urban territories. It's often a large losses of carbon associated with urbanization. When we clear land and clear the ecosystems away, that especially if the topsoil is cleared away, that much of that carbon is oxidized immediately and emitted into the atmosphere as CO2. And again, the idea at the bottom there is that urban areas operate as a carbon source, and they're often exporting a large percentage of their productivity into the surrounding areas. This is just a photo that shows that process of land being cleared and how drastic that can be. This is a very typical situation with topsoil and vegetation being stripped away for development. And a space on sort of what I would call an opposite ecological trajectory. This is our Olentangy Wetlands Center at Ohio State. And so here we had a group led by Professor Bill Mitch that took an open, vacant urban area next to the river and next to the university, and they turned it into a wetland research site. So they're getting all kinds of functions out of this place. They're collecting data, and it's a public park and a sort of a wildlife refuge and acts to some degree to store water and filter water. If we look at the practices and the methods, some of them at least, that we can use to manage urban areas as carbon sinks, we see that, as in all management for carbon sequestration, we get a lot of environmental benefits, that by managing lawns, urban forests, home landscapes and recreation areas to be carbon sinks. This supports biodiversity and provides productive landscapes and ecosystem services. And, you know, this green space really has a lot of different functions to it and values for urban areas, that by keeping open land and keeping green space in cities, we have ecological values. There are all kinds of economic values that I would associate really with recreation and, you know, savings on bad things that aren't happening, social values, planning, and even scientific values. We've seen that cities are a very fertile place to collect data and to try and understand how ecosystems function. So, looking just specifically at urban agriculture and putting land and cities into food production, we see that this same scenario has the potential to play out. We can have not only a food source that's bringing fresh food into places where it may not be readily available otherwise. There are ecological benefits to this in terms of having plant cover and land that can infiltrate water. There are cultural benefits. These urban agriculture areas are often very social places, and there are economic returns. We're saving money that people are putting into their local economy, and this is good politically as well. So there are a lot of benefits with that. To look at another model, something that we've looked at and are doing some research on is that when I spoke earlier about the outflows of primary productivity from cities, something that I'm proposing in my urban agriculture research is that, you know, that's a resource that we can be using to improve soils, and that these simple and basic processes that can be used to make compost and biochar from things like grass clippings and tree trimmings, food system waste. You know, there's abundant organic matter in urban areas. So it should be no problem to produce high-quality soil amendments, which can be used to increase soil carbon and ultimately soil quality and ecosystem function in urban areas. To just look at a few slides about urban forests and urban trees, a recent study calculated that for every 100 healthy trees, 136 kilograms of air pollutants are removed from the air, and 3.7 tons of carbon are sequestered on an annual basis as CO2, and that the economic return on the benefits of these trees is about 2 to 5 times the investment of planting and maintaining them. So this is, again, a carbon sequestration strategy with multiple benefits. and some data from Klaus Lorenz, who was a scientist in our group for several years. They went out and looked at carbon in the soil profiles of urban forests in Columbus, and Klaus calculated that there was about 150 megagrams of carbon per hectare in the top meter of the profiles of the urban forests that they studied. And as the first speaker mentioned, they found a lot of carbon not just from trees and from litter decay, but also from historical land use, municipal solid waste. They found a lot of charcoal. They had nice pictures of charcoal and coal down in the soil from the early 20th century. They calculated that there was a lot more carbon in the soil than the vegetation at these sites. And the large subsurface deposits of carbon that they found suggested that some carbon in these soils had made it through historic land use changes and disturbances that we would typically think of as oxidizing a lot of carbon, that a lot of subsoil carbon had remained in these forests through those conversions. Some issues that make urban soils distinct from other soils. We've already seen with the other speakers that there's very strong heterogeneity depending upon ecological conditions and land use history. And that there is also a possibility for contamination by heavy metal in urban areas. Some research priorities, home lawns, looking at just enhancing our efficiency and removing the costs of maintaining those systems. And also, looking at are there ways to manage lawns to get carbon further down in the profile. Urban forests, again, continuing research on adaptable species, continuing to evaluate these benefits of trees in cities, managing nutrients for trees. And urban agriculture is a very fertile area right now for research, looking at productivity methods, methods for improving soil, understanding water regimes, and a big one, management to reduce the impacts of contamination. And it's just I think a reminder here to keep in mind that as we manage urban areas to be ecologically beneficial, we want to always minimize the unseen energy that goes into doing these activities so that we can make them positive carbon sequestration. So with that, thank you very much.